Okay, let's go.
Right, I'm recording. We're recording. Everyone's recording?
I think so.
Ah, wonderful. Right then, it's not Series 5, Episode 5, as my notes are from the past. It's actually Series 5, Episode 7. 7, can you believe it? Of the Linux Voice podcast, which is here, which is what we're recording right now. Oh yeah, I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this thrill-packed podcast, we've got some news. Looks like quite spicy news this time. We've got our finds. We may or may not have some neurons to vocalise. Mike's turned his Hangouts video call down to audio only, so I can't even read his admittedly usually economic facial expressions for any clues. I have nothing other than ugliness. So we'll find out when we get to that section. We also have the voice of the masses. If you like the sound of this unique melange of facts, nonsense and opinion, you can subscribe to a paper-based form, which is Linux Magazine. That's linux-magazine.com. There you will find our words regularly, on a regular basis, every month, in fact. So there we go. I'm just going to hold my bottle of wine next to the microphone as I unscrew the top.
Oh, yes.
Real French cork.
And just a...
I'm sure I can hear a dog barking somewhere. Whose is that?
I hear no dog. There is no Dana, only Zool. So here we go. To our friends across the La Manche, good luck and bonne chance. Vive la République et vive la France et vive la news avec Ben Everard.
Les actualités.
La news ce week est le Microsoft is start selling le Linux. I'm going to stop this before it veers into wild xenophobia.
Stop talking our country down, Ben.
You ain't no patriot.
I'm a saboteur. What are you going to do about it?
Un saboteur. That's a French word. You can't say that.
I think if you're a saboteur, you can. right, yes. The news this fortnight. Microsoft has started selling Linux on consumer devices. So we've talked a little bit before about how Microsoft uses Linux in their Azure data center and even has created their own Linux distributions. This is the news that Microsoft is working with Samsung on a sort of special edition of their Galaxy smartphones that are selling in Microsoft stores and the like. So, okay, this isn't desktop Linux as we often use it, but this is still a Linux-based system being sold by Microsoft to consumers. You know, you can't even sort of wave the back-end sort of hidden thing about that we've, like it is with servers. This is direct customer focus facing Linux from Redmond.
So what does this mean for Windows Mobile then?
Well, it's not dead. Well, it's not officially dead. It's clearly not doing very well. That's all I can say, really. There's no word on it. It's obviously not a sign of strength from Windows Mobile.
I mean, it does seem that ever since that Satya Nadella guy took over, that they've been a lot more pragmatical in things. They've realised, they've recognised places where Linux is obviously dominant, like in so-called cloud computing, and they've just started to get on that, ride that wave. And maybe it's the same with mobile. Then they may keep pushing Windows Phone for a while, but they see that it's an Android versus iOS race, and they might as well get some money out of it.
Well, Microsoft famously makes a lot of money from Android anyway by with all their various patent licenses and whatnot.
That's true.
But yeah, this is it's clearly, as you said, a slow shift in policy away from Windows has to be the dominant platform to let's work with what other dominant platforms are to make money in a varied ecosystem.
It's quite interesting. I think I remember a quote, or maybe I slightly paraphrasing, but I think Linus Torvalds back in the day said something like, Linux has won when Microsoft starts making applications for Linux. And, you know, apart from Visual Studio Code, that hasn't really happened. But it's sort of come around the other side. You know, Microsoft supporting Linux on Azure, Microsoft selling Linux-powered mobile phones. So, yeah, we obviously won't get Microsoft Office for Linux as a native app for a long time. That's obviously something they want to keep on to. But, times are changing.
Well, Microsoft Office works on Android.
True. I guess the mobile apps do, yeah. But like you said before, when we talk about, you know, getting behind Linux, we tend to think of desktop Linux.
Yeah, this is still a long way from that, but who knows? Just a few years ago, I'd have thought this was a crazy idea, but...
Under Steve Ballmer, you would think the chairs would be flying across the entire Microsoft campus before even such a thing could be thought of, yeah.
Right, let's move on to our second item of news this fortnight, and that is it's more commercial news, actually. It's quite a commercial podcast this fortnight. Dell's high-end workstation, the Precision 5720, comes with Ubuntu or Red Hat, as well as Microsoft's offerings.
Is this a laptop?
No, it's an all-in-one thingy. So it's like a screen with the processor screwed onto the back and a sort of hard drive hammered in the side.
It looks really nice.
It's not cheap. It looks nice. It's not cheap. It starts at about $1,500. Yeah, that's for
it's got a really high
i5 processor.
It's got a super high resolution display, hasn't it? I haven't seen the story since last week, but I remember looking at the specification and thinking it's, you know, it's cheaper than the equivalent Mac.
Well, yes, let's have a look what the display is. Oh, it just says the Dell Liquid Crystal display with articulating stand. I don't know what that means.
Yeah,
I don't understand displays.
Yeah, you don't need to understand that, Ben. You know, you don't need to. You're buying the very best.
Yeah,
arcade best. Quality
don't worry
graphics
about
and sound.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think it is a high DPI, 4K Ultra HD.
There you go. That's lots of big. Big words. They must be good. I think what surprised me about this story really wasn't so much that it came with Linux, because obviously Dell have been working with Ubuntu quite a bit on their laptops, but that it came with Red Hat.
Yeah, that is. I was going to ask you about that because I've only seen it in your email. What is this Red Hat?
This is Red Hat's workstation.
Right.
This Red Hat, it's a Linux thing. You may have heard of it. I'm just scrolling down now. I've lost where I was on the page looking for the thing. Yeah, so it comes with Red Hat Enterprise Linux WS, which I assume is workstation, and you can get it with 1, 3, or 5 year subscriptions, with 1 year being $177.80 and going up to $716.80 for the 5 year version. So it's serious money for this. For the Red Hat. And all the supported governances.
That's excellent. I mean, yeah, it's great that I guess Red Hat are reaching out and there's more options for people when they're choosing Linux and hardware, more competition.
Yeah, I mean, I assume the Red Hat's there because if you're working in a sort of Red Hat environment, like your servers and whatnot, and you need to use the same code you're developing against stuff, then yeah, it might make sense if you're using other enterprise software that's only supported on Red Hat. Then,
you think CentOS would be useful in that case?
Yeah, I was about to say the fact that it's supported on Red Hat would give you quite a bit of confidence if you didn't want to pay that to put CentOS on it.
Yeah,
Obviously, I'm not guaranteeing that will work.
Yeah. But, so the resolution is 3840 times by 2160, and that's 27 inches. So that's a nice high DPI. I like that because I'm getting used to, you know, with our phones, I'm getting used to like high DPI on font crispness and all that kind of stuff.
I just take my glasses off and I can't tell the difference. It's much cheaper.
I've got a big screen, but it's not a very... Well, it is a high resolution, but it's a big screen, so the DPI, I can still see dots.
To me, that's not a bad thing.
No.
Yeah.
I was just about mention my Amiga connected to my old TV, but I thought, let's really not go down those lines again.
Yeah, people keep telling me Amigas were good, and they weren't Ultra HD.
They were better than Ultra HD.
Yeah, I bet Graham's beefing up his Amiga at the moment.
The fact that you had, you know, hold and modify mode, which made, you know, colour juggling so cool, and but the extra half bright mode where you had to juggle colour palettes in the same way that you flickered pixels on the Commodore 64 to get that extra colour. Don't get that anymore.
Yeah. Right, should we move on to the next item of news before we descend down a rabbit hole that is confusing me already?
People still want the Amiga podcast, you know.
True. In fact, we should make an Amiga magazine. We could crowdfund it.
No, never again.
This time it'll work, I'm sure.
Yeah, we just need something nice and relevant like Amigas. Yeah. You?
It's nearly 4 years on and we're still not out of it.
Right, news. More news. It's quite sad news. This is Debian contributor Dmitry Bogatov has been arrested. He's a Russian, arrested by Russian authorities on sort of various charges it's terrorism-related charges, but it comes from the fact that he's running a Tor exit node, and somebody's been posting basically invites to go and protest people and that sort of thing on forums in Russia via his IP, which obviously is because it's a Tor exit node, not because he's been doing the posting. The fact they're still posting these things while he's arrested in Russia, you would have thought would count as evidence to support him, but apparently the courts don't agree, and he's being held until his trial.
Running a Tor exit node in Russia, given the current situation, you know, it's very brave of him for doing that. I mean, you wouldn't want to run one in most countries, let alone Russia.
Yeah, I mean, when I ran one, I didn't run one in the UK. I always figured that I had an element of safety by running the exit node in a country I wasn't in. And the assumption that it would be very easy to show that it wasn't me doing it. And if anyone did want to start a legal action, it'd have to come across a border to get me. I don't know if that actually gave me any safety or not. I don't know.
Yeah.
But he was running it from his home IP, which isn't recommended because it's much harder to sort of show what traffic is yours and what traffic is the exit nodes. But that doesn't really sort of excuse the behaviour of the Russian authorities. I mean, it's clearly not him doing the posting that they're claiming.
On a related note, I saw something today and it was talking about alternatives to taking your laptop on planes to America, because there seems to be some news, or maybe fake news, but saying you can't even... Now, is that you can't take them in the plane cabin with you, or the authorities are getting so paranoid they won't even let you take laptops into the States?
I think this is fake news. GNU fake news.
Is that news you can edit yourself to make it fit whatever facts you like?
We need a truth cast. Mike,
what we need
unveil the truth cast.
We need Jimmy Wales to set up some kind of, you know. Jimmy Wales will save us. Has anyone ever seen Jimmy Wales and Julian Assange in the same room? Sorry.
I've always been a little bit surprised that you are allowed to take laptops in the cabin, because to be fair, laptop batteries are fairly explosive if you want to make them. I mean, they contain a
I would lot imagine
of
so.
Chemical energy.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Yeah, I mean, if I even start talking about this, I mean, I'll probably end up on the list or even more lists. But yeah, if you had a very volatile laptop battery and you could, you know, somehow press it against the side of a plane and, oh, look, it was a Samsung battery, so it's just blown a hole in the plane. Oops. Then, you know, you've got yourself a mini terrorist act.
I hear humans are quite volatile as well. I'm surprised they let them on aeroplanes.
I hear over 100 mils of breast milk can be extremely dangerous.
Yeah. It can be if I've been on gin the night before.
Oh, I've got some gin in the freezer. Brilliant.
The sad indictment of the reign of terror.
Fake terror.
As long as it's real gin, it can be fake terror.
Oh, you know what? If only people had actually read and understood the works of George Orwell about one does not establish the revolution in order to overthrow the regime. You overthrow the regime in order to establish a revolution and ministry of all of that and stuff. I really need to get revising, don't I?
Yeah. So, but yeah, I don't know. I think it's crazy. I'm sure that laptops are dangerous and there are lots of things that you can do if you really put your mind to it. This is just all some kind of veil of, I don't know, political outmaneuvering and, you know, security theatre.
Security, that's Bruce Schneier's phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, stuff is dangerous. Things are dangerous. Being alive is dangerous.
Yeah,
let's
not
do
Chuck
anything.
Chuck Norris from getting on planes. So... all of the security measures are pointless.
What I would think is actually is MacGyver. I mean, ban him from the corporeal realm, and then we're safe. Luckily, most terrorists seem to be thick, so we're all right.
I've always thought that's the only thing that keeps us safe: the fact that terrorists tend to be pretty idiotic. Which, to be fair, is also the premise of most superhero films.
Yeah.
The fact that you get the one that isn't.
Also, that's exactly what a secret terrorist would say.
Is it?
4D chess going on here.
My cover's blown. I'll quickly move on.
No, just say something
stupid.
We'll
leave this.
Stop the terrorism talk. Yeah. Listen, I work for it.
Andrew's disappeared.
They've got the saboteur.
Le saboteur.
So, yeah, I mean, we're sort of making light of this, but actually it did start on the quite serious story that Dmitry Bogatov was arrested, and obviously we wish him a speedy acquittal for crimes he quite clearly did not commit.
Hello, I'm back.
Are you okay? Have you been arrested?
It was a rough 2 or 3 seconds. I didn't say anything. I didn't squeal.
Right, next up on the news list this fortnight is the news that Dev1, the systemd3 distro, Fork of Debian, has reached version 1.0 almost. It's in the release candidate at the moment, so the final release is imminent. And I felt like putting it in rather than holding it off until next fortnight's podcast.
Fair enough. I think a lot of people thought it wouldn't even get this far, so, you know, fair play to them for going ahead with it. I still don't know just how big the user base is. I mean, yeah, plenty of people still have beefs with systemd, but, you know, it's pretty entrenched now in the whole Linux ecosystem. So, people are just getting used to it and getting along with it. But yeah, what seemed to start off as a project, I remember we were talking about it in the podcast whenever it started, maybe a year ago or more. You know, we wondered if it was actually a spoof, if the whole website was just some sort of joke with that terrible name that nobody knew how to pronounce. And then, yeah, here we are now, and it seems they've actually managed to you know, put their mouth where their foot is. No, what, I can't remember the expression, but...
their money where their mouth is. Got,
that was it, yeah, yeah. You can't fool me again, that's what I'm saying.
now watch this drive.
Now watch this drive, yeah. But no, you know, good on them for actually not just talking the talk, but walking the walk and actually getting some code out the door to mix all my metaphors up horribly.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'm starting to really like Systemd. The more I use it, the more I realize it's actually got, it's going in a really good direction for a lot of things. I know this is probably going to get me flamed, but hey, I'm okay with that.
No. That's interesting to hear, Ben. Just say, because you know, when we were all full time Linux journalists working on Linux Voice, then you know we sort of saw things from technology geek side. We were experimenting with new technology. We liked new technology. We liked playing around with it. But I guess now you are actually using Systemd in your daily work to actually get jobs done, and not just as a plaything.
Yeah, and it just simplifies so much stuff that. Yeah, you could do it before, and yeah, there's, you know, ways of doing things and all that, but it was really archaic, and it was sort of sat back in the, it basically worked the way it was designed in 1970, and it made sense at the time, and you could shoehorn it into new situations, but actually, Systemd works pretty well, at least for my use cases. It may well not work for others. But it's just things like service files are just so much more straightforward and actually quite powerful compared to all the init scripts. Timers, I'm actually starting to quite like the systemd timer files over cron tabs. They're just a bit more flexible and expressive.
I saw another discussion about this recently. I mean, you know, the systemd discussions will probably go on for another 5-10 years, but you know, somebody was saying, a sort of old school Unix admin saying, look, all the systemd complexity, I don't need it. I have this server, I just want to start it up and start all my services, and that's it. And the systemd proponent responded saying, well, that's fine. The problem is so much is hot plugging today. You know, devices come in and go out on a running system, network sockets open, services start and stop, virtual machines start and stop. And beforehand, with the old SysV init way, you know, you had all these sort of bash scripts gluing everything together quite clumsily. Systemd, for all its faults, and it is by no means perfect, is it just handles all this stopping and starting and hot plugging in a much, much more elegant fashion.
Yeah, yeah. And I said the sort of the user interface side of it, you know, you say, oh, I just want my services to start, but init files were, even a basic one was just a mess. And I can program bash scripts, but Christ, they're ugly to read. And, you know, service unit files are just really clean, you know, what, about 4 lines for a basic service file compared to a weird case statement and a load of other stuff. You know, it's integrating with containers and all that stuff, which does need to happen in a better way than old file init works. It's, you know, journal D just holds everything in one place. It's really useful for that. But anyway, sorry, wildly off topic. And despite the fact that I really quite like Systemd, I'm also quite pleased to see Dev1 pushing ahead, because, you know, I like Systemd. It works for me. I don't want to impose that on other people that don't feel the need to. I quite like seeing people solve their own problems. And if people have problems with Systemd and they're willing to put the time into, maintain a distro, the best of luck to them. And I hope it works well for them.
Absolutely.
But you said the name's bad. Have you seen their logo? It's awful. It's unreadable. They've tried to make an E with sort of the end bit of the U, the D, and the U.
Oh.
Have a look at dev1.org. I had to close it down. Sefin.
Sefin. So now it's time for Finds of the Fortnite. And there was, luckily, the IRC channel had some great finds earlier on today. There were some great discussions, and I'm using Riot IM to log into the IRC channel because it's too confusing through WeChat and a terminal. I can see all the people who flagged me up in Riot IM. It's great. That's a find. The first one is, we didn't quite talk about, but it's another fork of Unity, the Unit desktop. This is from Arubis Lander or Arab Islander. So it's another unit. It's the Unit desktop, another Unity fork. So I don't. There's lots of Unity projects carrying on. This is probably a good thing for people who like Unity.
I like Unity.
Recharge Unity from scratch, which they assume means a rewrite. Now, this I think is my find from the IRC. Are you there, Mike?
I am here. Yeah.
This is the Kickstarter project called ZX Spectrum Next. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't. Tell me all about it. I'm intrigued.
So this is an expanded and updated version of the ZX Spectrum, fully compatible software and hardware with the original. By the original,
what do they mean by that?
It's this by the original designer Rick Dickinson, inspired by his work at Sinclair Research. So I think if I look at the specification, it's got a Z80. It's got really? Expanded memory. I think it's got exactly this. You can kind of bang the hardware in the same way that you could the Spectrum. It looks like a Q. I don't know. I'm not great with my Spectrum food, but it looks like a QL. It's got like a QL-ish keyboard. It's got the conversation in, because we've got a games developer and corrupter on the IRC channel, who's also a member of the Facebook page that's discussing this. Some old 80s games programmers are getting into writing their games on this new Spectrum. Corruptor has even said he may try and do some version of Lumo on this new Spectrum, an isometric game. And it really does look like a great project. It's
What storage mechanism does it have?
So let me look at the specification right. So it's got 512K of RAM, so it's obviously expanded. It's got more color modes. It's got more hardware video modes, but I think it's still got the old ones. It's got an SD card slot.
Right, because there's a, you know, emulating the old hardware and everything's great, but if it was still cassette tapes, that would yeah. be ridiculous.
It's still got multi-phase functionality. Do you remember what was the turbo tape thing, tape machine for the Spectrum?
Oh, I just remember one of my mates back then, we were going back here, late 80s, early 90s, had a multi-phase thing where you could like pause the CPU and step through instructions and do
yeah, hacking
and
like stuff. The action replay or freeze frame.
Yeah, exactly. Now, does it have some sort of HDMI output?
It's got RGB, VGA, and HDMI.
Right. So what this is like similar to the NES Mini Market, I guess, the NES or the NES Classic, which Nintendo, for reasons nobody knows, has discontinued.
But it's not. But this isn't like a SoC that's doing it. It to all intents and purposes, it looks like the original hardware design in terms of the actual hardware registers and the way the computer's held together. It's not like an emulation.
No, but I just mean it's the ideal thing you can just plug and play, and you can just plug straight to your TV and use.
Yeah.
You know, we've the NES Classic in a way isn't actually that impressive. We can all do the same thing with the Raspberry Pi and the wonderful Retro Pi. But there's something so great about that little box to plug into your TV. You see why it was so popular. And this Spectrum, I think I'd buy it. Got way too much to do already, way too busy to go back to poking bits and bytes into video registers and stuff. But it sounds brilliant. Yeah. Well, I guess my big question is what's the asking price?
Right, so it's £99 for just the board or £175 for the whole thing.
Does that get you a load of games or anything?
Not unless you use your old collection. There are some new games being developed, and obviously it's pretty easy to get hold of some of those old Spectrum snapshots.
When you say use your old collection, how are you going to get them into it?
With a tape recorder? You can.
You can actually connect. You can connect a tape recorder to the volume jack on, or you know, the microphone jack on your machine, PC, laptop, record it and use some special tool to convert it into, I think it's a TAP, tape format, some compressed format. And
yeah. You could use FLAC in the worst case. I have got like an old synthesizer called a Korg Poly 6 that used to store patches on cassette, and I record the audio output from the Poly 6 into Audacity and then file them away and then simply play it back. So you could do that.
But that price is
it's cheap. That's it's not cheaper than price. An Amiga graphics card, Mike.
Well, true. But I don't think Amiga graphics cards are in the sort of stocking filler market like the NES Classic. If they got it down to like $49.99 or something, I would buy one. I wouldn't really be able to use it much, but it would be great. But $180.
This is what happens as our generation reaches middle age, you know. Instead of motorbikes and all that kind of stuff, we start buying expensive rebuilds of the hardware we grew up with.
That's true. I keep wondering at 36, when is my midlife crisis going to start? But no, I'm fine. You know, I've got plenty of gadgets, so I'm happy.
I think that's an awesome find. I'd seriously be tempted. I haven't backed it yet, but it's already been a success. I should say that it's 27 days to go. They wanted £250,000. They already have £305 on Tuesday night when we're recording this.
Wow! Brilliant.
Well done.
Brilliant.
So it's going to happen. So skimming back through the IRC channel, sorry, McPhail, this is excellent. This is Tomb Raider in a web browser. Open Lara. He provides the link. It's really nice doing it through. Oh, I don't know if you can hear that. Maybe I just clicked on the link and with the cursor keys, I am now playing Tomb Raider in a web browser. Possibly the best Tomb Raider. That was brilliant. That old Tomb Raider.
I never played Tomb Raider. Is it? Really awesome.
Yeah, I think it's difficult if you've not played it how it will be as a new experience, but at the time, forget about the way that Lara Croft became kind of sexualized and kind of stereotypical. In the beginning, it was such a neat idea for a game. It was difficult. There were parts of genuine adventure where you were climbing into holes and genuine surprise. I mean, everybody uses like this part where you see the T-Rex in like the Lost Valley, but there's a moment where you kind of climb through a load of rocks in a cave. You don't expect it, and you found like this Lost Valley. And at the time in the 90s or whatever, in this 3D environment, it was just groundbreaking. It was brilliant. And I've played it quite a few times. I played it on the PSP, and it still held. This was probably only about 8 years ago, and it still worked as a game. It was challenging, and it was adventurous, and it was good. Yeah, I think it's a good game. Skipping through, sorry, I hate doing this. Putty, there was a big discussion about Putty because people were trying to copy and paste commands from Putty, and apparently you can get Putty on Linux. Somebody made the suggestion this was like bringing coal to Newcastle.
Yeah, why? What benefit does that give you?
I don't know. John Lane says it can be handy if you want to script an SSH connection that needs to use a password and you have a reason for not using SSH pass. Hello, John Lane. James Olympus says a find here using strace to list files a process tries to write to. It's useful for packaging the files written by make install. Oh, that's a good idea. I was fiddling with this is a it's difficult when people haven't flagged up my name because I know I've skipped through past a couple now. Some discussions about Trump. I know that there's been a couple more that I've skipped over there, but I'll have to come back to them later because I don't want to have to pull. There's been a lot of discussion today. Ian Agogo, sorry. IKEA is selling smart light bulbs that are apparently done correctly. So
yeah, I saw that. Matthew Garrett gave him the thumbs
up.
Wow. As much of a thumbs up as he gives any IoT stuff.
Has he ever given an IoT thing a thumbs up before?
I'm saying this from memory. It's possibly I'm wildly correct. Someone gave it a thumbs up after looking through the hardware, and I just assume that in my memory that it's Matthew Garrett. But basically, yeah, it doesn't do any of the sending stuff back to servers or any nonsense like that. It does what you expect it to do. It stays locally. If you tell it to turn on, it turns on, and doesn't go to a server in China and that comes back and tell it to turn on or anything like that.
I follow the page now, and there's a list of things. It works out of the box. It has a local-only hub. It's based on open standard Zigbee and COAP-TTLS. It's affordable. Lights start at $12 standalone and $20 if bundled with a remote. It does actually sound really, really good if it's all of those things, and it's cheap, and it's open, and you know, there's no horrible stuff.
Yeah.
Well done, IKEA.
Yeah.
I saw Matthew Garrett today or yesterday was blocked by Jim Zemlin. Just throw that out there.
Matthew Garrett is an absolute hero. What a lad.
Jonathan, I don't think he even did anything, you know.
He just was Matthew Garrett.
Jim Zemlin doesn't want to have anything to do with that. John the Nice Guy, my find, Udemy have a massive discount for 40 hours. All video training courses are £10, some discounted from £200. So we're recording this Tuesday night. If Udemy training courses mean anything to you, then there's a huge discount on there.
It probably expires by the time you've heard that.
Hopefully not, if I manage to edit it properly. Oh, one for the Amiga podcast. There's a link to first impressions of the Amiga 1X 5000, which is a whole new Amiga PC. I'll put the link.
So that's a modern Amiga. Yeah. That's a modern Amiga. Yeah.
I haven't got my graphics card yet, by the way, so I can't give you a review of that. Still waiting for it to get through German customs.
I could have brought it to you when I was in the UK a week ago.
And I think we'll do the last find from here, owntracks.org. Your location comparison, I don't know what that is. It's from, who's found it? It's another one from me in GoGo. Sorry for getting the pronunciation wrong. Allows you to keep track of your own location. You can build your private locations diary and share it with your friends. It's open source and uses open protocols. That sounds brilliant. I imagine it's like you did years ago, Ben, which was track your GPS files with a server or something, but maybe some way of using that, doing that intelligently.
Yeah, I've got a feeling I used OpenTracks a bit at the time, but my memory's hazy.
So they are the epic finds from the ISC channel. Does anybody else want to have a go?
Yes, please.
That wine looks awesome.
It's really nice. I only got in 15 minutes before we started recording, so it's not quite cold enough, but it's a Picpoul de Pinay.
Oh, c'est bon.
Ouais.
Du vin?
Ouais, du vin de pain du pain? De Tesco. Oui. De Tesco Finestre.
Du bon sang.
Ouais. Ouais. Ah. Alors, to continue the frankly treasonous theme, I will announce this next find in a foreign lingo.
Chouette.
So, il est un exhibition dans 2018 pour explorer J.R.R. Tolkien's creative genius. I should have gone for Mexican, shouldn't I, really? El genius creative del J.R. Tolkien. Soy el focus del una exhibition mayor opening at the University of Oxford's Bodleian Libraries in 2018. So Tolkien, maker of Middle-earth, will explore the full breadth of Tolkien's unique literary imagination. And that is going to be at the Bodleian Library in Oxford from the 1st of June to the 28th of October next year. So I implore all Mexicans listening who have a dog named Bilbo and who live in South Gloucestershire to just get your sorry ass the piffling 40-odd miles to Oxford to actually finally look at the Rings of Power and all that stuff.
Oh, Ben and I will have to go and pick up Effie, drive him over to Oxford.
Yeah.
Drag him kicking and screaming.
Yeah. Bundle him in the boot of the car. The dead of night.
For an adventure.
Yeah.
An adventure.
The road goes ever on and on.
Aye. Yeah, so that's my El Discovery Major, but I also have un petit discovoir, which is that the Chromebook site website of El Google lists this Chromebook. I've just been looking at Chromebooks just now, and it's for storage. It says of this machine, 100 gig of Google Chrome cloud storage for free for 2 years. That's wonderful, but I don't really. I want to know about the actual machine that I'm buying, not the associated web services that you will give me and then monetize later with my freaky, creepy advertising details.
Yeah, you don't need to know about
that. You say that. I've had a Chromebook now for probably 3 years, and I don't think I've saved a single thing on it other than stuff that just needs to be temporarily saved to be printed or something like that.
So does that mean that
my documents are?
But that means Julian Assange knows everything about you.
Yeah, he knows everything about everyone.
Ah, true.
If you care about your privacy, don't buy a Chromebook. The fact that it's being the documents are being stored on Google servers is the least of the privacy concerns there. Which, to be fair, is a good reason not to buy a Chromebook. Or at least not to have it as your main computer and just be aware of its limitations.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. I've actually remembered that I've got a couple. Actually, this is something I really did do after work today. I fired up Simple Screen Recorder with the intention of recording a really quick overview of my Linux desktop because a few people have been bugging me for it and I promised it ages ago and to share it in this podcast, and I have done it. I said it was meant to be super short, and I had a list of things that I put into a file that I was going to cover that I thought were cool, and it ended up being 17 minutes. So I might have to have another look at it and see why it's taken so long. But anyway, I've done a video of my KDE desktop. If anybody's interested, the link will be in the podcast notes.
It's taken 17 minutes because you use KDE.
Yeah, maybe. You have to see. The other thing is that Qt browser, my favorite web browser, is doing another crowdfunding campaign to fund a month's development for the developer over his summer break and his break at university. It's a great, if you don't use it, it's a web engine based web browser that uses Vim keyboard bindings and interactive and normal modes to do all the web stuff. And it's a really great thing if you suffer from RSI or you just don't like moving away from the keyboard. It's lightweight, it doesn't spy on you, it's quick, it doesn't take up anywhere near as much memory as Firefox. And recently, it's almost as compatible as Firefox with most sites. I think the development that he wants to do is change the configuration system so that there's a per-domain configuration that you can use if you need to, plus kind of further scripting options, and local config and GUI config.
Graham, you said that was another crowdfunding campaign. How many of them have they done now?
He did one last year, which was for the web engine backend. Because I think he's at university doing something useful, and so he has a couple of months over the summer where he'd ordinarily get a job, but he kind of puts it out there that if he can get a few thousand euros together, then he can afford to work on Qt browser rather than getting a job.
I just think it's interesting, and I think it's pretty cool, the idea of a small recurring crowdfunding campaign.
Yeah, like Critter, yeah.
Yeah, like Critter. We all tend to think of the big ones to launch, you know, big projects or products like we did ourselves. But recurring things, if people are still there and, you know, the next year they can say, look, what we did last year, Chuck, give me another five or another tenner and I'll work on this. Then, yeah, good luck to him. Great.
So he wants 6,000 Swiss francs and he's got 5,682. So it'd be 22 days to go. So it looks like he'll succeed. The other thing, and I suppose the closest thing to a Linux find, is that I wrote some scripts in Tmux, which is a really useful way of scripting certain kind of things. So I needed basically a MIDI synthesizer to launch at the same time as an open sound control port server. And if I do this in Tmux, I can open it up, I can split the display and script it into like one thing rather than having to worry about doing nohup or forking processes with bash. It's a really great way of running a script that launches into Tmux and you can see it. So Tmux scripting is a thing, and Tmux has like commands for entering keys into something, so you can kind of automate, you know, terminal applications if you need to. That's my Linuxy find, and they're my finds.
Shall I go next?
Yes.
I've only got one find, but I'm quite impressed with it. And it's called Street Complete, and it's a mobile phone app that's kind of works with OpenStreetMap. And you download it, and it looks at where you are, and it tells you things around that OpenStreetMap doesn't know. So it'll say, what's the name of this road, and when are these shops open, and what, you know, is this road a tarmac road, and all this sort of stuff. How tall is this building? And it's really simple things. You don't have to think too much. You don't have to go and do too much. It's just, I can see that building. It's 3 stories high. There we go. Saved. And each one is like a tiny, they call them missions, they're tiny little ones, and it picks them up all around where you are. And it's just a fantastically easy way of contributing to OpenStreetMap, which I personally think is a really important project.
That's really cool. Somebody needs to combine that with something like Pokemon.
Yeah, I've just been doing it. Just spent sort of half an hour earlier today, and I just fired off just a whole bunch of stuff nearby where I live. And I don't know if it's useful to anyone, but it's there now in the cloud. And hopefully I'm going to continue doing it. And
I don't know what's happened.
So Ben has been arrested by MI6 and is now being extradited to Sweden to face charges. So Mike, did you were going to tell us about snooker or something, weren't you? Oh no, okay, it's Ben.
Yeah, so
oh, no, Ben, here he is. He's in the Ecuador embassy.
I'd like to thank my friends in Ecuador. It's very comfortable here, and I can confirm that both Julian Assange and Jimmy Wales are here. Street Complete, it's great, it's really easy to use, and just quick ways of adding information to the global open source knowledge of the world. It's great, get it and do it.
Awesome. And that does sound brilliant.
That's my find.
As our legal editor, I'd just like to add that we in no way think that Jimmy Wales has done anything that would necessitate him being extradited anywhere for anything.
I'm pretty sure Theresa May thinks he has, though.
but he's used the wrong hashtag, so Amber Rudd is after him.
That needs
so,
you,
snooker.
Mike.
Tell us about snooker. Give us a happy story, yes. Mike.
Snooker, there's a wonderful sport. I don't have many Linux discoveries, and when I say many, I mean I don't have any, because I went to see the World Snooker Championship last week, live in person, which was really cool. And even that's not a discovery, because I watched some snooker, and it was brilliant, and I enjoyed it. But also on the same trip, I did discover that I am now in the same group of people, the same class of people as Elon Musk, and that we both have reusable rocket systems. I bought an Estes model rocket. It was about like 20 quid or 25 quid or so, and a bunch of engines and a parachute system. And I launched it off the coast of Morecambe Bay. And it was so cool. It was an unmanned flight. I need to make it clear it was an unmanned flight. But then again, so is SpaceX. So, you know, we're similar there. But the when I ordered the rocket, it said to buy these like A1 engines to launch it to like 30 meters or so. And I was like, okay, let's knock it up a bit. So I ordered motors to send it up to 200 meters. So it was quite exciting to launch it. I'm slightly concerned I've violated air traffic laws and things, but you know, you've got to live. But yeah, it was really cool.
Is Morecambe Bay isn't under any flight path, though, is it? Surely it's not on the way to anywhere.
Not. I probably really shouldn't be talking about this, but you're right. It's not under any normal airport flight paths, but they use it for military training. Often, you would get these really low flying giant bombers coming up over Morecambe Bay, heading up towards the Lake District, and you get some jets as well flying around there. So, some training for the military. Occasionally, it happens. You know, that's probably even worse to interfere with. I don't know what the consequences will be, but, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, just erase your brain with a mind rubber, and let's say we never talked about that. But also buy a model rocket. They're really cool.
So did it land on its own as well? I mean, you...
Yeah, what it does is the engine burns at the bottom for only about 3 seconds, but it must be like 50 G or something. It just zips up into the sky, and then the engine pops out a bit of thrust at the top, which pushes out some wadding, and then it pops the top off the rocket, the little model rocket, yeah, and pushes a little parachute out. Now, the parachute's like the size of a Tesco carrier bag. It's really small, but the whole thing is very light anyway. But, you know, it then flutters down onto the ground, because we did it on Morecambe Sands. It just landed onto, you know, soft sand, and then you can put another engine in and relaunch it. So, yeah, I have a reusable launch system, unlike NASA. I mean, that's saying something, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be fair, they probably have some model rockets at NASA.
Do you reckon?
But at NASA, does anybody ever trudge slowly over soft sands back to the bench where your clothes were stolen?
Exactly, Andrew's got it right. Yeah, I did have to. It did go over a little.
What, you were shooting rockets naked?
That just makes you Kim Jong Il, not Elon Musk.
Wait a minute. You're right, actually. So,
Is this a Linux Voice exclusive? This is Kim Jong Il fires rockets naked.
I'm not comfortable with this now. Image I have in my head.
Other dictators are available. We do not wish to insinuate that Kim Jong Il, who's dead anyway, uses Estes model rockets. Estes model rockets are used purely by democratic societies.
The other one.
Which one?
The
other one. Kim Jong version 2.
Kim Jong 2. Oh dear, I'm so sorry, everybody. Right, is it time for the halfway reminder?
Yes, let's do it quick. While we still
still to come, we have Mike's extradition. We've got extraordinary rendition for Graham, and quite possibly we may indeed have some neurons to vocalise, but we definitely do have Voice of the Masses. Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned, because it's coming up in 3 seconds, because there are no neurons.
That means it's time for Voice of the Mass.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I stayed late to be shouted at by my boss, so I'm in a bit of a giddy mood. Right then. What's your favourite programming language? A nice and simple one for this episode, but don't just tell us what you like to code in. Why do you like it? Have you been using it for years, or are you a recent convert? If you can't choose a specific language, do you feel more at home with higher level or lower level languages? Let us know your thoughts in the comments below. Right, this is easy. The best programming language is Python.
I agree. Let's go home.
Does anyone disagree with that? Right then.
Sounds like your dog does.
My dog disagrees with everything. He's a Westie, so he's genetically Scottish, and he's from the northeast of England. So he's, well, let's not go into that.
I do think Python could be done better. I haven't got another option for Python, because it's become such a huge part of everything, and it's a good language, but there are parts of it that really annoy me. The formatting really annoys me.
How do you mean the formatting?
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
just curious.
The insistence on the tabs, and the way that the indentation of things actually signifies their significance.
In many ways, I think what I like about Python isn't the language itself. It's all the stuff around it.
Yeah,
it's got a great set of modules and all that sort of stuff. And honestly, the language itself, I could take or leave. It's the ecosystem of Python that makes it really powerful.
I also think the dual system of 2.x still being around and incompatible, and stomping over 3.x or 3.5, and versions of 3.5 not being fully compatible with 3.4, the various different ways of installing Python and its associated modules, pip and PyPy and apt-get and all those other things, and people using virtual environments to run their Python in small little containers. It's a great language. It's powerful and it's easy to use and easy to learn and gives people loads of kind of power at their fingertips. But I think it's grown so large. It's grown much bigger than it was ever intended to grow.
Did you say, yeah, Graham, there's some incompatibilities between 3.5 and 3.6?
Well, yeah, things like for example, this week, Python bindings in Firefox were version 3.4 or something, and some of the scripts that I was using were updated to 3.5, breaking the Python bindings. That seems to happen. I know this happens in other languages, but if you were to design a language today based on the success of Python, I think that would be an awesome language.
Well, yeah, or at least maintain compatibility in the 3.x series, because I've funnily enough, I wrote a book about Python, the Haynes Coding Manual, that's going to be published on May the 11th.
Hey,
yeah, so
that's great. That should have been
my second Haynes book after 7 years. But yeah, so it's going to be published on May the 11th, and I wrote it based around, I think, Python 3.5, and I made it quite clear in the book, like, you know, this is about Python 3.5. Future versions should be compatible, yeah. But, you know, my previous experience of writing computer books means things can break quite quickly. So, they should at least keep everything compatible in 3.x releases. At least that's what my opinion.
Okay, so it sounds like Python is the best programming language. Let's hear from some saboteurs who want to undermine the will of the people with their non-compliant opinions. First of all, Nigel Green says, PHP, particularly now with the Laravel framework. I learnt it as a route into programming ages ago, and I've always come back to it when I've wanted to put together any kind of web app. It's much maligned. But since also discovering and using Laravel, I'd need quite a pressure to push me towards trying to pick up anything else. Good coders can write good code in PHP. Well, rules me out. I do remember the PHP tutorials written by Paul Hudson back in ye olden times. And it may be because Paul is such an incredibly clever chap. But I found that as a non-coder, I could read those and understand them. So if anyone wants to read PHP, wants to learn PHP rather, I would Google Paul Hudson's name and read anything he's ever written, because he's awesome. bless you. Sophie says, I've been using Java for my job for nearly 20 years now, and I've grown so used to it that sometimes I think and dream in Java. I do that in Tetris sometimes. Every once in a while, for hobby projects, I try out a new language like PHP or Python, but every time I feel to be losing a lot of time just getting to know the language and quickly switch back to Java. Chemist69, my favourite programming language is NIM, nim-lang.org. It combines the expressiveness and ease of use of Python with the speed of C because it is a compiled language. Ah, cheeky. So we've not touched on this, have we? Interpreted versus compiled. What difference does it make when you're trying to learn a language versus when you're actually using it?
Would say it's... Oh, go on, Ben.
I say one of the big advantages with interpreters is you can often use them sort of live, as it were. So with Python, if you use Python, you've got the Python command line and you can type stuff and see what happens as it goes along. That's often not possible with compiled languages, although there are exceptions.
And it used to be the case that, you know, compiling took a long time. If you had a reasonable sized program, you would type some code, compile, wait ages, and then you could try it out. And the benefit to obviously interpreted languages was that you could see your changes straight away. But for any small program, as a beginning programmer now, even a compiled language, is even C++, it would compile in half a second, a small program.
Right then, on continue, as the French would say. Charles Malpass says, Python, because I am not a scientist and not a programmer. And then there's a little asterisk underneath. I'm a scientist. Yeah, I thought that tickled me slightly. Not GCHQ Honest says, I personally really enjoy using modern JavaScript with a functional programming approach using Node.js. The availability of quality packages via NPM, the Node Package Manager, makes using third-party code a pleasure. JS performance is still improving due to it being the language of the browsers, and tooling has come a long way since the hideous days of IE6 error messages. And Mark C says, JavaScript, for me, it's the only language that's universally available on any modern device via the browser with no need to install anything else or play which library should I use to do something like network access or display a user interface or image on screen. JavaScript then. I read about half of the missing manual guide to JavaScript on a train back from Glasgow roughly this time last year. I remember some of it. Should I persevere?
It really depends on what you want to do with programming. Although you can do a lot with JavaScript, it really, its natural fit is the browser. And if you want to do user interfaces and web stuff, JavaScript's the way to go. If you want to do other stuff, you can shoehorn it into JavaScript, but it's always going to be a complex way of learning it. I mean, Node is actually, I've only used it a little bit, but it is quite an interesting way of programming, but I'm not sure I'd recommend it for a beginner.
Well, my dog is obviously angered by JavaScript, so let's join in with Damien, who says, trying to keep ahead of JavaScript is like running of the bulls, where the bulls are all on crack cocaine and you're wearing flip-flops. And I don't know, it's a bit late now, so let's wrap up with Neil McPhail, who says, I think I'll always have a place in my heart for Z80 assembly language.
Yes. Yes.
What was the language of choice on the Amiga?
68K assembly language or C, I think, Greg.
Yeah, I mean, it came with BASIC, as we discussed. You could get assemblers like DevPack. I spent quite a lot of money on SASC for the Amiga, but exactly like Mike was saying, it took 20 minutes to compile a simple tool. It wasn't actually as accessible as those really early 8-bit computers where you had an interpreter right at your fingertips as soon as it was turned on.
Yeah. Does GCC work on Amigas now?
GCC.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you can. You probably not in Amiga OS. I'm not sure, but you can install Linux on an Amiga.
Well, as a connection for the ultra geeky amongst us, the Amiga had I think it was DCC or Dylan's C compiler made by a guy called Matt Dillon, who then became when the Amiga pretty much died for most people in the mid late 90s. He then moved on to FreeBSD, and then that wasn't a stab at you, Graham, that was a general. But then he went on to FreeBSD. He did some pretty amazing work in FreeBSD. I think he fell out with some FreeBSD developers, and of course he made now Dragonfly BSD, which is still going. I think it's pretty much a one-man project or still quite a small team. But it was DICE. It was D-I-C-E, the Dylan's Integrated C Environment. It was one of those things I used to see in the Amiga magazines thinking, oh, one day I'll be a clever enough programmer to buy and use that, like DevPack. But of course, I never got clever enough, so.
I have to admit that there's a couple. I still use C++ after learning it on the Amiga. It's a bad thing to do and a bad habit to have gotten into, really, because I know there are so many easier languages to use. And it's not actually that I'm any good at it. It's only that I'm familiar with it and I struggle with it all the time. But I think maybe like you, Mike, I also quite enjoy, it's pretty close maybe in many ways to assembler, to the hardware and the way that the computers work, like the threading stuff I've been struggling with. And I quite enjoy the challenge of trying to make stuff work in my head rather than the language helping me out a lot of the time. And I think that's why I can't kind of use C. I use other languages as well, but not so much in my spare time. I use C.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally agree. So Yeah, even the question, this voice of the master's question, which of course I wrote, you can have multiple answers. My favorite language, what I'd like to code in, just as a purely satisfying geeky thing, is assembly language. I like being down on the hardware level. I like poking bytes around inside the machine, doing Game Boy games. But of course, that's not remotely practical for day-to-day work. So I think Python is probably one of the best languages out there for learning programming, getting stuff done, getting things put together. It's not necessarily the best performance. It's not necessarily the best for embedded. The geek in me loves assembly language. So my life is a mixture of assembly and Python.
You see, I came to a similar conclusion when I was thinking about it. For me, the two languages I really like are C, for exactly the same reason. It's getting down and dirty. And when I'm using C, I'm usually using it for a reason. I need to do something low level. I need to turn pins off and poke data to here and there. And that's, I don't know, it's nice to get down to that level. It's not just fire data off to the network and see what comes back and all that sort of thing. And my other potential answer is BASIC, because it was the language I learned in, and it's something still, I don't know why. You should have to type numbers at the start of lines in programming. It's just better somehow. Start with line 20.
Which computer was
this? This is on Commodore 64 and later A3000. And that way you only got sort of 9 spaces. So you had to think a little bit about what numbers you put. And then you could only edit so much. And I don't know. It was just not, I don't know. I'm probably just looking back with rose-tinted glasses. I definitely am. But I liked BASIC.
I got very disappointed when later BASIC programmers didn't have to put the line number in. You know, it seemed like such a cheat. Sorry, Andrew.
Yeah,
that's it. I was just going to wrap it up by saying, after Python, the very distant number 2 is Ruby, because you can get stuff done with it, and it's readable and it's functional. But as I say, it's 1 minute past 10 in the United Kingdom, while it is still a United Kingdom.
Too late.
Which the sun... Oh no, I will. Anyway, so it's time. It's time to go, isn't it, really? So I've got to get up for work in 8 hours. So there we go. Yes, please... subscribe to the podcast, read the podcast, listen to the podcasts, and all of those things, and let us know your thoughts, comments, rants, raves, etc. Do please write letters to our editor telling us how great we are, and continue with your lives, humanoids.
Awesome, thanks Andrew. Goodbye everyone.
Bye, everybody.
See you in 2 weeks. Bye. Also.
Bye-bye. It's such a nice day.